All right. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Yamhill County Board of Commissioners formal session, January 15th at 10 a.m. Commissioner Sterrett, you want to lead us in the flag salute?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you very much. Next item is our calendar session. Is there any additions or changes that need to be made?
None for me.
None? Okay. D is our public comment. I have one right now, but it's going to be for item I-7, so we'll call up Todd when we get to that. If there's anybody else in the audience that would like to give public comment, raise your hand or fill out the card. If you're online, raise your virtual hand. Seeing none. So we're going to move on. E is department updates. And we're joined by our district attorney, Kate Lynch. Welcome. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, Commissioner King, Chair Johnston, Commissioner Sterrett. Thank you for the opportunity to update you about the District Attorney's Office over the last year. So I want to provide all of you a brief operational update. Focus on our performance over the last year, workload, some expected trends, possible decision points coming up in the future. I'm also going to flag any issues that I think you might want to pay attention to for the future for possible board awareness. We started 2025 off in a challenging place. We were actually down 5 prosecutors last January, starting in 2025. I'm very pleased to report that we have exactly 0 vacancies in the prosecutor department. So we've managed to fill all of those vacancies. And that has been a huge shift, not just in morale, but also in our ability to perform and serve the community. So we're in a much better place than we were just a year ago. This is going to be review for all of you, but I thought it was worth mentioning just as a review point. We do have 12 funded DDA positions in our criminal division. We have 12 funded support staff division positions. We have a couple of those are legal assistants. Most of them are legal secretaries. We do have 1 paralegal. We have 3 funded crime victims assistance positions, and CVA has had a challenging year, which I'll get to in a moment. We do have 1 CVA director, office administrator, and we do have a newly created position of office manager. And that is not an additional cost to the county. I basically took 1 management position and then I reallocated it to be a direct supervisor over our administrative support staff. And that's worked really well for our office. As I think all of you probably know, our office works really hard. We provide not just prosecution for the county, but we're on call for law enforcement questions 24/7 for 6 different law enforcement agencies in the county. We answer legal questions, we review search warrants, and we're really involved from the initiation of investigations to try to make sure that we're on solid legal footing for every case that that comes to us for review. We have specialized domestic violence prosecutors, specialized child abuse prosecutors, once a specialized elder abuse prosecutor, Measure 57, a repeat property offense prosecutor. We prosecute Deweys. We have a special drug prosecution position for our drug enforcement misdemeanors, which I know this board is aware of. We cover mental health court, commonly referred to as a CCS or court-coordinated services. And we also have an assigned prosecutor for our adult recovery court. And those participants are primarily our Measure 57 repeat property offenders. In our juvenile department, that is not my budget, that's DCJ's budget. But we do have one DDA who is allocated to prosecute juvenile crimes. Unfortunately, for most of 2025, that position was vacant, so that put an extra strain on my prosecutors in the criminal division, but we managed to get the job done, and I'm happy to report that we now have a full-time DDA in who covers all the juvenile cases. Along with prosecuting juvenile delinquency cases, DDAs also cover what's known as juvenile recovery court, or it's just a drug court for juveniles. And as this board is aware, a couple years back, the Department of Community Justice eliminated their crime victims advocate position. So that did put an extra strain on our crime victim services division, but we do provide services to the juvenile department as well. We're also responsible for covering civil commitments in the county. And there was a new House bill that took effect in January that you may be aware of. It's House Bill 2005, and I'll get to that a little bit later about how that very well could increase our workload. With our support enforcement division, we have one funded DDA, we have one program supervisor, and we have four caseworkers in that division. I'm happy to report they're also fully staffed. Here's our year in a snapshot. Last year, in 2025, my office filed 1,639 cases in circuit court, so that's quite a bit. Of those, we had 184 domestic violence cases, 96 child abuse cases, 39 elder abuse cases, 332 DUI cases, and that was the one category where there was a slight decrease in numbers, about 10% reduction. And overall, we had just shy of 1,400 victims who were supported by CVA. Now, that's about 200 fewer victims than 2024, but we did that with essentially half the staff for most of the year. We did have some CVA vacancies, and because there was some uncertainty related to funding, we chose to keep those vacancies open until we were assured that funding would be restored. So I'm pleased to report that I think as of next month, right, Cecilia, we should be fully staffed with our crime victim services division. But again, we struggled a bit with CVA, but we were half staffed. And part of the year that was intentional because of the uncertainty with respect to the VOCA grants. Our support enforcement division, not quite $5 million, but just shy of $5 million, they collected on behalf of children and families in Yamhill County, and that's a tremendous service to our community. So we accomplished some of our goals. We filled our DDA vacancies in 2025. That was a big goal of mine. We're now fully staffed in SED. We expect to be fully staffed in CVA next month. We're very close to being fully staffed in administrative support. We do have one intentional vacancy right now in our, it's a legal secretary position. We did have someone leave, and I chose to keep that position vacant because we are going to be facing an unexpected cost, which I'll get to in a moment. So in order to kind of save a little bit, I chose to keep that position open. I'm really, really proud of our efforts to increase efficiency, and specifically in the criminal division. We've updated a lot of processes. We're better utilizing technology. I want to talk a little bit about that because I think it just really deserves praise. My management team really deserves some praise here. We reorganized our management positions in the criminal division. I'm pleased to report that at this time, I don't really think that we have timeliness or backlog indicators. We're not getting discovery out late to defense counsel. We've kind of alleviated the delay in the set aside processing that we were facing. So delayed filings on our part are not really, I don't really see that as an issue at this point. We have worked out quite a few technical issues. I'm going to just give an example of what we had done for years. You know, when an individual goes to jail to be booked, and then we prosecute that individual for X crime, we would request the booking videos. And what would happen is jail staff would have to retrieve that booking video from the system. They'd had to download it on a CD, send it to our office, do billing, bill our office for it. Our office would receive it, make copies for the defense, sometimes mail out the CDs, and then enter the bill and then process the cost. I mean, think of all those steps. It's one county agency to another. And so I'm going to give the sheriff's office management team kudos, because we're like, can we just not work out a better system for this? And I'm very pleased to report that process is all digital. Nobody gets billed, and it's very simple and straightforward. So that's just one example of many changes that we've made to operations to try to be more efficient. If something has seven steps, can we eliminate any of those steps and still get a, you know, a good result? Everything now is pretty much digital versus printing things out, signing them, scanning them. Like, that just doesn't make sense. So everything now is pretty much digital. We've eliminated most of our thumb drives and our CDs. That's a cost savings on supplies, postage, and most importantly, our staff time. So our legal secretaries, I was talking with my office manager and asking her how much time are our legal secretaries saving now that they're not having to copy disks and thumb drives. And conservatively, that's about 15 to 45 minutes a day. And I know that doesn't seem like a lot, but let's think about how many staff we have. Like, that's 12 positions, 15 to 45 minutes a day conservatively. It's just a tremendous cost savings over time. We have a better, consistent, formalized onboarding processes for our new employees. We had our DDA 1 positions restored in the last budgetary process, and I'm pleased to report that not only have we been able to hire for those DDA 1 positions, but I think we've trained them really well. It's a long process to get a prosecutor trained, but I would say that they're both just flourishing, and that's directly as a result of being fully staffed and being able to dedicate that time and the attention that we really need to allocate to new employees. So that's been a huge improvement. We've really improved our collaboration, I think, with our community partners. And again, the Sheriff's Office management has been tremendously helpful in working through these inefficiencies with our operations. We have made some headway with providing consistent quarterly training to law enforcement. We have a couple search and seizure trainings, refresher trainings scheduled for this month and next month. But that's a future goal that I want to pay more attention to in 2026 now that we're fully staffed. Community outreach, we did some. But I think we can do a much better job in 2026, especially now that we're coming close to being fully staffed. That's a 2026 goal of mine. Let's go to expected trends for 2026. As I mentioned, House Bill 2005, I fully expect that that's going to result in an increased number of civil commitment hearings. The last quarter of 2025, we had 12. I think, if I'm remembering correctly. And so already this month, actually, I think we had just two yesterday. So House Bill 2005 basically makes it easier for judges to meet the criteria that is needed to civilly commit an individual. And, I think that I agree with it, actually, but it's going to very likely increase our workload. Think about civil commitments and what amount of time that takes. I mean, it's not like, I'm not going to say it's going to be a crisis, but it's an area we're going to definitely have to monitor. The last 4 months of 2025, we handled 12 civil commitments, which each of those carries about 2 to 3 hours of prosecutor time and about 2 hours of legal assistant time. But overall, I think it's a good thing for the state. There's broader standards for judges to determine whether commitment's appropriate. There's also expanded, facilities and services available to folks. So our drug prosecution, I thought this was noteworthy because, and of course, this is to be expected with House Bill 4002, But we filed just 226 drug-related cases in 2024. Excuse me, and there's a typo there, and should be 2024. But last year, we filed 383 cases, and that's an increase of about 70%. I think this board is familiar with the SCAN team, the sheriff's office, basically the narcotics investigation team. Because we're fully staffed, we've been able to really collaborate with that team from the very beginnings of these investigations. We're able to work closely with officers to review search warrants, to talk about legal issues from the very beginning, so that when those cases get to our office, they have a higher degree of likelihood of successful prosecution. So I fully expect that to continue in 2026. I have about five cases. I don't have to go through all of them, but I did think that these high-level dealer cases that we were able to prosecute are worth mentioning. We started the year off in January. This is a case that I put up, State v. Snedden. And this individual had 13 prior convictions, 10 for drug offenses, 5 for prior deliveries, been to DOC a couple of times. The facts are up there. But essentially, this individual had, 2 baggies, 458.41 grams, and the other for 371 grams, which is a lot. So this is a high-level dealer. And both of those tested positive for methamphetamine. There was some cash on the individual's person. And we were able to successfully prosecute the individual and got guilty verdicts for delivery and possession of substantial quantities. That resulted in 81-month DOC sentence, which is that's a pretty hefty sentence for a delivery. State v. Sessman, this is a sheriff's office drug enforcement team from last June. This case involved 23.3 grams of meth, or basically 230 doses, 13.8 grams of fentanyl, over 130 doses, plus 192 pills. This individual pled guilty to both delivery and possession of fentanyl, substantial quantity, and then 29 months. Another case in June from the sheriff's office. These individuals had multiple convictions between the two of them. Notably in this case, there were children living in the residence, ages 4, 6, and 14. The two older children had positive UAs for fentanyl at the hospital, and the youngest was referred for hair follicle testing. One of these individuals pled guilty to a commercial drug offense of delivery, possession of fentanyl, as well as endangering the welfare of a minor, received 25 plus 34 months DOC concurrent, and then the other individual received 45 plus 40 months DOC concurrent. And there's a lot more examples, but I just tried to pick a few for this board. This is a MACPD case. Again, this is a high level dealer. Had 24.8 grams of cocaine and 3/4 of a pound of meth. Pled guilty, 42 months of DOC with 15 months concurrent. So again, I fully expect this trend to continue. Unfortunately, it's not because all of a sudden we have more drug crimes in the county. It's because we're actually able now to investigate and prosecute these drug crimes that we're seeing these kind of results. I wanted to just flag I mentioned the waiver hearings, the expert witness fees, and that's for one of our juvenile waiver hearings. So we currently have, is this board, I believe, is probably familiar with the change that happened back in 2019. With 1008 and juvenile crime prosecution for Measure 11 crimes. Everybody familiar with that? Maybe not. So prior to 2019, it was up to a district attorney whether or not a juvenile would be charged with a Measure 11 crime. Kind of in a nutshell, there was some legislation that happened in 2019 that now moved that decision to a court. So the judge decides versus the district attorney. And what the state has to do now when we believe a juvenile is appropriate for waiver to adult court, we have to go through a specific legal process that is called a waiver hearing. So we have to file a petition, and then it's quite complicated. There's a lot of work involved. And essentially, at the end of the day, if the judge agrees that the juvenile is appropriate for waiver to adult court, then the juvenile will be waived to adult court and prosecuted as an adult versus a juvenile. We have one currently that is a homicide case. And actually, my chief DDA, Sarah Vogel's here. So she spent the better part of December getting ready for this juvenile waiver hearing, which hasn't concluded yet. The judge has yet to render her opinion. So I wanna not comment on the facts too much, but I do wanna talk about all of the time associated with these waiver cases. We have a second one too, which I'll get to in a minute. But this particular case that we are seeking waiver on that had Sarah busy for the better part of last month had 8,900 pages of discovery materials, 200 hours of video footage, over 1,500 photographs, 15 disks with additional evidence such as cell tower data, phone extractions. There were 9 different law enforcement agencies involved in the case. And let's assume 1 minute per page for review. That's still 148 hours to read, 200 hours to watch video, who knows how long to review the rest, you know, minimum of 40 hours, prep time for the hearing, at least 100 hours. The hearing itself spanned 5 days. That doesn't include meeting with witnesses, meeting with the victim's family, additional briefing. Administrative support overall has put in about 100 hours on this case, factoring all the evidence, discovery, transferring, all of those things. And that even doesn't even really touch the significant law enforcement time spent on this case. That's just one murder case. We do have a second case right now involving attempted aggravated murder for another youth. And we'll be seeking waiver on that case as well. To successfully waive these cases, we need experts. And so in the case that Sarah argued last month, I think the expert witness fees are likely to come in at about 30K, which is a lot, but it's really what is required to be able to get the appropriate result in the cases that we're seeking waiver on. So that's an extra cost, but it's a cost that is necessary to get a just result in this particular case. We're going to have a similar cost with the second hearing that we have. That hasn't been scheduled yet, but it will be scheduled. So I just wanted to flag that for the board. Again, we tried to mitigate that as best we could with the legal secretary position being left intentionally vacant. This was not, the CVA vacancies were not, I didn't want to do them, but I felt like we needed to wait on those until we had secured funding. But as a result, CVA was half staffed for the better part of 2025, and that put a huge strain on Cecilia's team. So despite that, they managed to do really good work. We did have to scale back on some services provided to victims, but we continue to provide core services. We continue to participate in our MDTs. CVAs continue to respond to call-outs for sexual assaults. They continue to sit in on law enforcement interviews when requested, as well as assist law enforcement with death notifications when that needed to happen. So that brings us to deflection. Sheriff's probably going to have more updated numbers than this. This is from last month, but the board might be interested to have a quick deflection update. And since September of 24, we've had 2,003 referrals, 146 qualified for deflection, 42 were actually assessed, which I know it sounds discouraging, but with this population, the challenges that they face is actually quite high. Higher than I would have expected. Currently engaged, we have 9. There were a number who did not complete treatment. A lot of folks who were referred for prosecution and subsequently charged failed to appear, not just once, but multiple times. And so But again, after if deflection doesn't take, then we try the prosecution route. They're offered conditional discharge, and if that fails, then we land with probation. But that's just kind of where we're at with deflection currently. We did also apply for and receive some additional resources for deflection. Part of the additional resources include additional funding for our deflection prosecutor. So that prosecution position will now be 100% funded instead of just 75, which is good because there was a 25% position lost with the loss of the marijuana grant. So that compensated for the loss of that grant for the deflection prosecutor. We also have received partial funding for a senior office specialist as well as a crime victims advocate. We also received funding of up to $150,000 over 2 years for restitution for victims. So that's a really positive development. We'll be having a community partner meeting later on this month to kind of work out those details, but that is something that is promising for the future. So I'm happy to answer questions or provide any follow-up materials if the board has any questions.
I do. So you mentioned during your presentation about focusing more on public outreach and communication there. Do you have just a specific thing that you're looking to improve upon, or?
Yes, I am. And actually, I've had a lot of discussions with Cecilia Martinez, our crime victims services director. And the goal is for victim services to be out in the community more, to really do community outreach, talk about the services that we provide to victims. That's the primary goal. I do think that support enforcement, I would like to see them in the community more as well. I think they have a lot of really important information that could help help families in Yamhill County, and they do exceptional work. So I want folks in our community to know about their exceptional work, the exceptional work our victim services does, and how they might be helped by our victim services division. And if I could just turn to Cecilia and ask if she has anything that she'd like to add.
Partnering up with some of our agencies like Juliet's House or Henderson House, we usually work together and do presentations to the community. So we each talk about what our agency does and services that we can provide to the community. So that's what we're hopeful that we can do more of moving forward.
Cool. The reason I bring it up is I'm very appreciative of that. Because I believe we have other departments too that are also having that as their main focus to be basically advertising better of what our services are. Because I run into people quite often that are like, the county doesn't do this. I'm like, whoa, yes, we do. And we spend actually quite a bit of money on it. So I really do appreciate the effort that will be put into doing that. So thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the update. In terms of deflection numbers, they seem discouraging, yet Yamhill County has one of the most successful deflection programs. When you talk about those who don't qualify, what is the disqualifying criteria in those cases? Because it seems like we've got 9. You had, what, over 2,000 referrals? Or, and then you had...
100.
Yeah. So again, it does seem like, you know, in terms of the money, it would be, you know, questionable as to whether or not this is impactful, but you're tasked with making this happen. So kudos for Yamhill County's being so successful. What's the criteria?
The criteria for deflection, it's all actually written down and I'm happy to provide it to you after this update, but essentially, you know, individuals have kind of a certain number of bites at the apple if right. They've participated in previous deflections. Oftentimes, if they come in with more serious crimes, deflection's not appropriate. Like if somebody is charged with a burglary in the first degree and they also have a drug enforcement misdemeanor, that's not going to be a deflection case, for example. Right. If they come in with a Measure 11, if you know, and there's other things that would make them potentially ineligible, but we really want to screen out those folks who are going to be best served by this program.
Yeah, thank you.
Do you have a, maybe you said it and I just missed it, but a potential cost increase, and you probably don't know yet for the 2005, the House Bill 2005 or 2005?
So the question is related to.
Yeah, you just said there potential cost increase for your staff and.
Oh, there's going to be a cost increase. And Cecilia and I've had multiple discussions about this. We
Don't know
explored,
yet.
yeah, we explored whether or not we could give you a preliminary estimate at the time of this update, but we're still waiting on some things from finance to be entered. And what we would give you now would be just a rough estimate.
Yeah.
And Cecilia, I don't know if you have anything more on that.
No.
Yeah, it seems too early to tell, but everything else is just praise. I know the last time I saw the deflection numbers, they were quite a bit lower than that, and I've heard a lot of from our colleagues around the state that and other HHS departments and so on that we do have some of the highest numbers in the deflection. So kudos to you, and I think your vacancy rate is quite a bit lower, and so and I know that you are rounding that year and a half-ish in your term here. So obviously, your leadership in that area is being seen to be very welcome and a nice change. So great job,
Thank you,
and thank you for
Commissioner.
being here.
And I have to give credit to my team.
Yeah.
You know, not just my management team, but also my team as a whole. They've worked really, really hard.
Well, I agree.
Thank
I
you.
see you guys work and it's top down. So good job, all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kate.
Appreciate
Thank
it.
you. All right. We are going to move on to item F is our work session. There is none. G is consent agenda. There is none. H is old business. H1 is discuss area of liaison for 2026. This was me from last week pushing this over. What I wanted to do was reach out to the chambers in the area and see if they're willing to be added to our liaison duties. They are more than willing to be added to it. So, what I would propose, and if you guys are okay with it, is that we would add McMinnville Area Chamber of Commerce, Shaolin Valley Chamber of Commerce, Sheridan Chamber of Commerce, and Willamina. And
Willamina and Sheridan are separate, correct?
they're separate, correct? Yes. So, what I would propose is that I would take McMinnville Area Chamber of Commerce, Sheridan, and Willamina. And if you would
Sure.
like to take
My
the
stomping
Cahalan.
grounds for sure.
Okay. Sorry, I have nothing for you.
Well, I just want to clarify, there were a couple of we weren't sure about whether voting encompassed member or voting member, and I wanted to point out that my voting member on the Adult Recovery Policy Committee, so that one is a voting member because it wasn't listed as such, so that was the
Okay.
only change on ours.
Okay.
Thank you.
So Kevin will note all those, and if everybody's in agreement, we'll get it all updated and call it good.
Thank you.
The only one that I was potentially curious about and oversight from last year and learning everything was Parkway. I'm transportation, and so should Parkway come under transportation or not? If you guys wanted to have that conversation.
So far as for what I'm doing with Parkway, there's, I would keep it under, at least for me, I would advocate for that because I'm very well entrenched with
Sure,
what
you
we're
do.
doing for
Right.
the Newburgh-Dundee bypass. In fact, we just met again this morning and had some
Yeah, Thursday.
very high-level conversations of what's going on.
Sure.
It doesn't keep you obviously from, you know, coming in
Yeah.
and attending
Yeah.
and I think it would definitely help because everybody has different connections
Sure.
as a advocacy role
Okay.
for that. But no, I mean, I would advocate right now that I would definitely want to keep that. And if you're looking for a nexus to another liaison department, I would say Public Works would more than fit into that far as a transportation, which I kept on mine.
Sure. Yeah. I know they get foggy, right?
They do. Wait,
Yeah.
oh, there's kind of, I think you can
Yeah.
make connections to every
It's all
single
of them. Yeah.
liaison duty if
Yeah.
you wanted.
That's
So,
why there's three of us, but it's not one. Yeah, I'm fine with that. I'll can you, or maybe I'll get Ken or somebody to give me information on the parkway.
I'll email Dave Hagerberg.
Perfect.
And he'll email you the Zoom meetings, and Portia will get with you.
They're Thursdays at 7, right? Or
Thursday at 7:30. Yep.
7:30.
Yep. All right. Anything else?
No.
Do we need a motion for that, or are we?
I think just as long as we have consensus.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. Cool. Thank you very much. Item H2 is consideration of approval of an ordinance and findings in the matter of approving a zone map change from heavy industrial to light industrial with a limited use overlay for tax lots 4318-801 and 4318-900. The applicant was Charles Eggert, and declaring emergency. I would move approval.
Chair Johnson, because this is being passed as an ordinance, we need to do the first and second reading, and upon unanimous approval, we can declare it an emergency.
Okay.
So if there's no objections, I can go ahead and do the
Any objection?
None.
None for me.
None. By title only, yes.
Yes. Yep. Thank you, Christian.
Please.
Okay. So this is the first reading of Ordinance 944. In the matter of approving a zone map change from heavy industrial to light industrial with a limited use overlay for tax lots 4318-801 and 4318-900, applicant Charles Eggert, and declaring an emergency.
Pause for effect.
Hearing no objection, here's the second reading of Ordinance 944 by title only. In the matter of approving a zone map change from heavy industrial to light industrial with a limited use overlay for tax lots 4318-801 and 4318-900, applicant Charles Eggert, and declaring an emergency.
Fantastic. All right, now you need a motion and approval.
Yeah, now it would be time for the board to discuss and deliberate and then take action.
Okay, I would make a motion of approval. Is there any further discussion?
None.
None for me.
None. Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job, Caleb. And now we are moving on to other business. Other businesses. I1 is consideration of approval of amendment number 16, agreement number 026028 between Yamhill County Health and Human Services and the Oregon Health Authority, Board Order 24-029, in the amount of $6,300, retroactive to July 1st, 2025 through December 31st, 2025.
Chair, these retro funds allow us to bill OHA for non-Medicaid patients, so I would move approval.
Motion's been made. Any further discussion?
None.
None.
None. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. Item I2. Is consideration of approval of amendment number 5 to agreement number 185833 between Yamhill County and the Oregon Health Authority for Public Health Services, Board Order 25-269, Oracle number HHS 25038 IGA.
Chair, I would move approval.
Motion's been made. Any further discussion?
None.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. I3 is consideration of approval of amendment number 7 to the provider agreement between Yamhill County Health and Human Services and Yamhill County Community Care Organization, Board Order 20-457, retroactive to January 1st, 2026 through December 31st, 2026.
Chair, I just want to make a note that we do have substantial funds that are in reserve, and we are going to be able to deal with some of these, but currently the budget is being built, so we're going to have to address these, but I would move approval.
Motion's been made. Any further discussion?
Agreed.
None. Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. That brings us to item I4 is consideration of approval of amendment number 3 to the local mental health authority, local public health authority, and coordinated care organization agreement between Yamhill County and Yamhill County Care Organization, Board Order 23-004, retroactive to January 1st, 2026 through December 31st, 2026.
This is a systems change for us, but ultimately I don't think there's going to be any operational changes, so I would move approval.
Motion's been made. Any further discussion? None. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. Moving on to item I-5, this is consideration of approval of construction services contract with Hayworth Inc. and notice to proceed for the GSB Government Services Building Improvements Project in the not to exceed amount of $1,548,454, effective upon approval through August 1st, 2026. If there's any questions on this, Kevin can fill us in, or Don is in the audience.
I hear Kevin's the expert, so
if there's any questions,
I have none.
No, just kidding. Yeah.
Okay. I would move approval. Is there any further discussion?
None.
None. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All right. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. Item I-6 is a consideration of approval to submit a letter of support for the Northwest Early Learning Academy and the request for $1.5 million in funding through Business Oregon. This is a grant to kind of keep them moving along. They've started construction, and they're looking for different support throughout the area in writing this grant for Business Oregon. So I brought this before the board. I'm not sure if they actually emailed you also for the letter, but I just put it into one to see if the board would just sign on complete for the support, and if you guys are okay with that.
Yes, and Arthur Chaput at Business Oregon says it looks pretty good for us. This is sort of a nudge that the applications and everything is closed, but there's $20 million of the $50 million left, so it's looking good, but thanks for putting this on.
Okay, and this is just a reminder, the county's already invested in this project a little over $700,000 so far, so this will be good. It's a good, very, very long-term project for childcare in our area. Motion's been made. Any further discussion? None. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Motion passes unanimously. Thank you very much for that. That brings us to item 7. So I need to clarify with Patty, and then Don Schultz should be online, and I need to know if Patty wants to present, or if you want to let Don present, or...
You have Todd as well, the public comment over there.
You're right. Yeah. So I'll wait for the presentation, and we'll do comments after that. You want Don to do it? Okay. Can you promote Don, please? Don, if you can hear us, accept the promotion. Please. And Don's going to be on a very tight schedule, so he'll probably do a really quick overview. And if he misses anything, Patty will back clean up. There we go. Welcome, Don.
Hello, do you hear me?
Oh, 1 second. Can you try muting and unmuting again, Don?
Sure. Any luck?
There we go. Yep, perfect.
No, sorry, I'd stepped out of the room thinking this wasn't going to happen for a while. I came back in and there was an invite, so sorry about that.
No worries. I know you're on a tight schedule, so if you want to give us a quick rundown on your presentation, and I know you've also emailed it to us, so we have it.
Yeah, well, I actually don't have it right in front of me. If you give me 20 seconds, I can probably pull it up, and it'll just help guide the conversation, make it go a little bit quicker and more effective. Just give me 1 second.
No worries.
Patty, while we're waiting, do you want to introduce yourself for the name and address for the record?
Yeah. Good morning, commissioners. My name is Patty Herzog. I'm the executive director for the McMinnville Economic Development Partnership, and I'm looking forward to sharing CPACE with you today.
Good morning.
Okay, now, and you know, first of all, thank you for allowing me to speak. I wouldn't say I was completely prepared. I thought it was going to kind of be in the background a little bit, but, you know, I really do appreciate the opportunity to share a little bit about CPACE. Just by way of introduction, I am Don Schultz. I'm with a company who is PACE Equity. We are a private capital provider that lends through the CPACE program. So, you know, we are one of the, what I like to call the three legs of the proverbial CPACE stool, the others being the actual developer sponsor, real estate sponsor, if you will, and then the local jurisdiction, which in this case would be yourselves, the county. CPACE has a, and again, I don't want to go in crazy detail, but happy to answer questions, is it, CPACE itself is a, it's a financing tool. And from a county or, you know, city, local jurisdiction perspective, it is very much an economic and incentive, economic development financing tool. Okay. The history of the program is it's been around about 15 years. They're state legislative programs. They're in about 39 states today throughout the U.S. Oregon obviously has one, but they rely on local cities, counties, you know, the local jurisdictions to stand up and administer their own local CPACE program. CPACE itself, it's, you know, it is an acronym. It stands for commercial, is the C, and then PACE is property assessed clean energy. Property assessed speaks to how the funding or the capital gets paid back. It gets paid back via a special assessment on the real estate. And clean energy, some, by the way, some states, you know, use capital expenditures, but the concept being is that the capital funds energy efficient improvements in commercial real estate. And that can be new developments or existing buildings in which you do renovations and improve them from an energy efficiency perspective. So it's really centered around making buildings better from an energy efficiency perspective. Again, it is private capital, so it does not, it is not looking for any kind of funding from, you know, local jurisdictions, governments. It is 100% private, so there's no, you know, funding that's coming from, you know, the tax base or the taxpayers or anything like that. And like I said, the repayment itself is secured by a voluntary property assessment lien that goes onto the real estate. I just, from a numbers perspective, know that there's been almost $10 billion funded to date through the program throughout the U.S. And the awareness and use of it has grown significantly in the 15 years it's been around, but in particular over the last 3 to 5 years, it's becoming more and more mainstream to builders, developers who want to build new or renovate existing properties. So just again, I don't have a sense of the awareness. So, you know, I apologize if I'm going too deep or not deep enough. So in the process is such that, and it's obviously partly why we're here today, is that the states pass governing legislation at the state level. And not all, but most states then, Oregon being one of these, looks to the local county or city to stand up and administer their own programs. And so that, you know, it would be for the county in this case to adopt a resolution, launch the program and administer it appropriately. There's a handful of counties and a couple cities in Oregon that have done it. You know, happy to go into those. I'm not going to go through them now unless people, you know, want me to, and happy to do it maybe towards the end. The program itself, like I said, it funds energy efficient improvements, but maybe an easier way for folks to think about it is it funds a lot of the work you're already doing on a project, but it governs and ensures you're doing it in an energy efficient way. So think of it as all of your MEP, mechanical, electrical, plumbing type work, as long as it's done, you know, in an energy efficient way, which, you know, it's, think of it as in accordance with the legislative program. And again, as adopted and written per local guidelines, that that portion of your construction will qualify for CPACE capital. And it's things like it's your HVAC, your you know, windows, your roof, your insulation, your plumbing, your electrical, lights, all those kinds of things, and your anything that is energy efficient, you know, related. And that's both primarily hard, but also some of your soft costs, which obviously are required in order to implement those. It can be applied to all kinds of commercial real estate property types, multifamily, hotels, office, retail, industrial, medical, senior living, all kinds. It does not apply to residential. I think there's probably, I think there's three states in the U.S. that still have a residential PACE program, but just for clarity, this is purely commercial. that, you know, from a benefits perspective, there's benefits to the sponsors, the builders, developers, as well as the, you know, arguably the local jurisdictions. From a builder owner perspective, it allows for long term financing, you know, upwards of 30 years in terms of the term of the how the financing works. And since it's such long term, it actually helps developers, builders from a cash flow perspective. By building a more energy efficient building, you're arguably, you know, improving the value of the building because it is both it operates at a lower cost because it's more energy efficient. So, you know, from an operating income perspective, that helps increase the value. And it's a unique kind of financing since it is a special assessment that if the building or asset sells, the assessment itself automatically transfers with the property. But it can be paid off. And again, happy to get into more details if people have questions on that. From a local jurisdiction, local government, in your case, the county, it is very much an economic development tool. So those builders who are looking for, you know, that piece of capital to help them get a project launched or that they otherwise wouldn't, and or existing owners of buildings who maybe have older buildings and in need of improvements from an energy perspective that otherwise wouldn't do it, it gives them a very viable and easy to access source of capital to do those improvements. Like I said, we're not touching any taxpayer money, so it's completely private, so we're not looking to that. So there's no government funding at risk, if you will. The local jurisdiction, the county in this case, gets to implement fees for, you know, to cover their costs as well as to arguably provide, you know, a source of revenue. So fees are, you know, paid to the local jurisdiction as part of it. You know, there's the public benefit of the just overall the building stock in the county improving and becoming better, more healthy, et cetera, around that. And from just for awareness, too, because I get this question a lot, is from administrative burden perspective, the county itself, it is limited in that the what we ask of the jurisdiction from an administration perspective, somebody has to be identified as the administrator. I don't typically see it as any kind of a full-time job. It's just a duty that somebody else typically performs because the volumes aren't that high. And from a process perspective, I would just tell you it's somewhat akin to a permit process. In other words, an application is made, the local individual, you know, confirms it's in accordance with the program and then approves it. And again, a lot more detail, but that's the general concept, is that from an administrative burden, that there's not a lot ongoing. There may be a little bit up front to get the program stood up, but understand most new jurisdictions, when they adopt, it is very much typically a copy paste from existing programs, just tailing it for their local use. I can go through the process. I don't know if people want me to. I'm going to skip past that now, but if that becomes a question, happy to do it. So that's I'll say sort of the high level 101 summary of it. Happy to answer questions.
Do you have any questions, or you want to
go ahead,
or even Patty, if you want to jump in?
I do have a few questions. Yep. Thank you very much for that. A couple of things. Wanted to know what the restrictions were whenever we hear the word energy efficiency. I know I do get a little concerned. In Oregon, we've gotten rid of coal-fired plants. We have renewable energy. Our electricity rates have skyrocketed. They're finding out all the health impacts to LED lighting. So I'm wondering if these restrictions and requirements for energy efficiency are going to mandate these types of things and discount some of the other, perhaps more stable, tried and true types of energy components.
I don't necessarily govern that. It's really the legislation that governs what would qualify, right? But I guess all the elements you just described, they would all qualify for the capital, the CPACE capital. But if there's a desire to, I guess, restrict or direct it in another way, potentially, I guess a program could dictate that. So I don't know if that really answers the question, because again, I look at it from we operate in accordance with the written legislation. So it would really be going to that, I would think, as a source document to determine what is allowed and what's not. But I wouldn't say it necessarily pushes one over another in terms of improvements.
Jared, if I could.
Yeah.
CPACE is a financing tool. And so the authority is given by the local jurisdiction to accept this type of financing tool. As far as further restrictions on environmental type programs, energy efficiencies like that, that would be separate and would have to be other legislation. It isn't part of this work. I think it's really important to focus this on, it is a financing tool that allows the private sector to do this and record it onto the property so that it's transferred with the property and remains there. The benefit is a lot of these kind of programs like solar power that would go on a building to reduce their energy costs. Those are very expensive to put in. And so a lot of business owners postpone doing that work and it just doesn't have a good ROI for them. So this is a tool that allows them to put that improvement on the building and finance that cost over 30 years, as Don pointed out, and it remains with the property. So if that building sells, if that property sells, that lien then transfers to the next owner. So I hope that helps clarify a little bit for you.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that we're not basically, and I do understand the purpose of the program. I just have some concerns about the limitations that might come with that. And then also, when this came before the board years ago, we had some concerns about the admin costs. And when it's described as just another duty for someone to do, I know we've got staff who are overburdened as it is. I want to make sure we're not heaping something else on not only admin, but and then I had a question about the using this as a source of revenue. To what degree is that even possible? But these are all things I guess we'd have to suss out if we were to move forward.
Yeah,
my question was, sorry.
No, go ahead.
My question was the same as admin. Where does this fall under? I see Derek here. Yep. Does this fall under his stuff? What would be the burden, the cost burden to the county on that from an FTE standpoint and workload?
Let's hold tight on that. Patty, do you want to add anything else for the presentation?
Yeah, just a few things. I think Don did a really great job of explaining.
1 second. Sorry about that. Don, I understand that you're up against the time limit. So if you go away, we understand.
Okay. No, I was going to say I have to go in about a minute or two, so I'll stay for the couple.
We appreciate the presentation. Thank you.
No worries.
Yeah, just a couple of things to add. It's seismic retrofits from rehab is another thing that this program can be used for. HVAC improvements. So I think you've received a letter of support for the program from John Deese, at general manager at McMinnville Water and Light. So this is something that Water and Light Commission is looking at reducing energy costs for businesses. And so this would be another tool that could be done, be used for that. And also water conservation can be another way this program is used. Again, the county doesn't finance guarantee. There is no risk to the county as far as those business deals. Those are between the lenders like Dawn and the property owners to get that project done. As Commissioner Sterrett pointed out, I was before this commission probably 2 years ago, maybe three.
It was longer than that.
I think it was four or five.
So I'm kind of a dog with a bone when it comes to this. And just waiting for the right time, because it is a very valuable program. Doing economic development here in McMinnville and also throughout the county looking at it. It's just another tool that helps our companies be more competitive. And when I see this program is offered in counties like Washington County, which I think Kevin, our deputy county administrator, has some information on. When I was working with Joya, the previous economic director, she's seeing this program popping up in other areas. And we just want to make sure that our businesses here have those same opportunities available to them as well.
And currently we have two businesses interested in this in the short term.
Correct. Okay. And one of them is here today, and I don't know if you want to invite
not quite
them.
We're not quite there yet. Yep.
Which is also impressive, because talking with Kevin, there's, you know, Washington County has had four take care of this, and we're a fraction of their size. So
yeah. If I could add one last comment,
yes.
It came in after the deadline for public comment, but the mayor, Mayor Morris from McMinnville, and also the interim city manager have also submitted public comment.
We actually
comment.
Received that.
Okay.
Yep. It'll be put in the packet.
All right. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you. So good with presentation wise. Any other questions for Patty?
Thank you, Patty.
I don't think so.
Okay. If we got something, we'll have you come back up. I'm going to ask Derek to come forward because I think it'll address some questions here about cost and staff time. Good morning.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Morning.
It's a little triggering to be back in the basement, but I'm here. Derek Warfey, I'm Hill County Assessor and Tax Collector, and now GIS Coordinator. So administrative costs or administrative burden, is that what you're looking at? So a little background, I did the initial presentation 3 years ago, I think we decided. And I sort of echo the same thing. There hasn't been a lot of notable activity there. I think you just mentioned Commissioner King about a handful in Washington County, a much larger footprint. But the program has been in place for a long time, and Deschutes and Sherman and Clatsop, Hood River, they all have adopted, and they've come at it different ways. I believe Washington County is the only one that is managing in-house, meaning they're using an economic development department to handle this program, whereas the others have outsourced to sort of a consortium that will provide administrative oversight for smaller counties. So we would there could be some options. Initially, the thought I had is the upfront setup, getting all the documentation, the program, the outline, the forms, applications, approvals, agreements. There's a heavy lift there. There are an existing two or three very sound examples to pull from. So they're and tried and true. They've been in place for a long time. So we wouldn't be developing de novo, but we would be customizing something to make it Yamhill County centric. After that adoption period, post resolution to adopt the program, there isn't a lot of administrative burden transactionally. We load special assessments on tax statements for other programs already, everything from Cove Orchard to the Oregon Forestry Department. We load them on tax bills. What I haven't heard yet, and what I would probably have the most pause in what it would look like administratively, is what happens in the event of a default of the loan. We are in this program, you are collecting the debt service through the tax billing platform, and you're creating a lien on the real property that's associated with the tax billing. There's some benefit agreements and documents that, you know, they keep the county protected from a liability standpoint, but a procedural process is going to have to happen at some point if there was a default. Yeah, it speaks to using statutes that are already in place for foreclosure in light industrial districts, economic zones, et cetera, where we're assessing special assessments and ways to foreclose on properties that are in those zones that don't pay. But we're not foreclosing on tax payments. We'd be foreclosing on debt service from a private sector capital investor. So it was somewhat short notice, Commissioner King and Chair Johnston. I did, and thank you, Kevin, for coming over for a brief chat. I did ask my peers in Deschutes and Hood River if they had had any defaults and, you know, how much time, effort, labor was put into that. But on a routine basis, given the frequency of how many of these could be, if it was two for Yammer County or even four, I put special assessments, which would be a similar mechanism, on the tax bill for, you know, 5,000 forest accounts. So I don't see a heavy lift there. The other thing is there's, and I would assume this is how it would go if we decided to move forward, is the administration of the program in terms of an application approval, all the paperwork's in order, collaborating with the capital partners is all done through the economic development. Either relationship, if you have one, or person, position. There's nothing in statute where the assessor or tax collector approves applications for this or really has a role other than I'm given the authority from through this ordinance and this program to add something to the tax bill, collect it, turn it over, that kind of thing. So.
And Kevin, we did confirm that it is an ordinance.
There's actually not a requirement for it to be an ordinance. Most of the counties have adopted it through that mechanism. I think probably simply because it provides a routine public comment piece to that. And just to add to what Derek said, I anticipate this would, the administrative side of this would reside in our office because we do have the economic development issue. And so far, Washington County, who I've been in contact with, they just finished an evaluation of the three-year period of their program. And they've figured out that it comes out to about 24 hours of work per petition, per application. And the bulk of that is in the administrative review and approval. Once that's completed, it goes back to the private partners for completion of that with for recording and filing and all that. So it's not a huge burden as far as time goes. And given the infrequency of these petitions that other counties have seen, I don't see this as a major impact on our department at present. There's also a fee that is charged for the application. So it's 1% of the value of the project or 2,500, which is whichever is less, to a maximum of 15,000. And through that mechanism, Washington County has found that they have recovered 90% of their costs, including the startup costs through those fees. So it's really almost a break even at that point for the county on that matter. And they've been going for 3 years. And like I said, they've got the four projects. So
what's the 10% that they didn't recoup?
I don't know. I expect that's in the startup work. They estimated that it took about 100 hours of staff time, including council review, public hearings, and things like that, to get it established. So okay. That's where I would expect that 10% remains, is in that setup period and the initialization of the program.
So if MEDP is offering to do that portion, it would be 100% covered then as far as costs for the county.
Yeah.
Would that?
Yeah, I think the longest tenured county that I'm aware of is Deschutes, and talking with Scott, my peer assessor in that county, he said it wasn't a money maker, but it wasn't a loser. It wasn't money out the door, but it wasn't significant enough of a fee that we were actually creating revenue.
Right.
So yeah, I think there's a space, especially with outsourcing to a third party provider to do the upfront piece. And that's where you're recouping. Other than that, you've just created an economic incentive. So, again, I don't know what it would take from a legal counsel or my office in the event of a default in the foreclosure process. We're spending a lot of time on foreclosures right now. So that might be something to be mindful of, or at least explore further. I have not heard of anyone who had, I know that some have failed in the state. I just don't know which county and who to get a hold of to say, what did that look like? How much did it cost?
Patty, do you want to come back up, or John, or let's see if you have any answers or knowledge about that? Because it seems to be, I think, out of everything,
now, it'd
be the last thing we're coming down to. We don't know when it gets to the foreclosure process.
Yes, on the foreclosures, again, it's between the lender and the property owner. So the lender would be the one that is involved in that. From what I've asked of folks in the profession, as Dawn is, national experts on this, they have said less than 1% foreclosure on CPACE. And the improvements are on the property. So I don't know from a government perspective how they're involved in those foreclosures, but you know that is collateral, and the bank is going to be ensuring that, and also the local jurisdiction, those tax liens, they still remain senior over anything else. So any tax fees that are owed to the county would be senior to any of the CPACE liens.
So as we go through that process, then we'd recoup our fees through the...
I would think so.
Properties that are owed back taxes, that's where the county ends up recouping their costs back.
We wouldn't be taking ownership through this foreclosure, though.
Right.
Right. So they're not default on ad valorem tax. They're default on a special assessment, which is backed by a lien by a capital provider. So almost like a mortgage foreclosure. But in the event that they're not paying their special assessment, it's actually they're not paying their tax bill. So it falls under a foreclosure process in my office under a specific statute I don't have right offhand. I just don't know what that would look like. Would we get money back for that? I would assume we would charge something, especially if we're doing it on behalf of the capital partner. That's some of the assurances they're taking is they're getting a higher priority lien and a very solid and reliable revenue stream. You know, I've spoke about our collection rates in the high 95% in the first year and then 99.7 after four. So we don't foreclose on a lot of anything. Couple that with I think you projected a 1% national default rate on this program. You know, we're kind of shooting for what could be, I don't know. But I wanted to share the uncertainty of an administrative burden that could be, I don't know. I would find out more for you if with a little more time on who has gone through that. But yeah, when I think back on pros and cons and incentives for the capital provider, why are they in this program? A lot of that has to do with the stability around the collection and then the assurances through foreclosure.
Okay.
And that would be our role, okay. Which might be a policy decision. So I don't want to.
Any other questions for Derek?
Not for Derek.
Patty, do you want to touch on anything that Derek said? Okay.
Do we want to arm wrestle at all?
My money's on win. Patty.
Thank you, commissioners, and again, happy New Year.
Yeah, and stick around.
Thank you.
What's that?
Stick thank around you. Just in case.
Okay.
Our next phase is going to be our comment period. I want to make sure that we recognize the comments that were put into the
package. I did have one question, and I think this might be for Patty. So there was some reference to some of the upfront costs and that MEDP had offered to. Is that something you would bear, or that is that something you would hope to recoup from application fees?
From the fees. So what I've heard that there is an administrative burden to managing this program. So in conversation, what I've offered is it's a checklist process, and we would take on the burden of working to make sure that a complete and finalized packet would go to the county. They could look at it, say, check our work, and then it would be reduced that level. But we would share in that fee split for the work that we're providing on behalf of the county. So for instance, the fee structure that Kevin pointed out, the 1% up to 25,000, we would work out an arrangement as part of this program that whoever your administrator is that's providing this service gets a portion of that for making sure that a complete application comes before your staff. So they're not doing the legwork of, you know, making sure, oh, this wasn't filled out correctly. So that's got to go back. It's really making sure that the packet is complete and finalized. And then the check on the work would be done by the economic development group at the county. Takes off a layer of burden. But we would also ask to be reimbursed from the fees for providing that service.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And you wouldn't see a scenario where there wouldn't be enough that you could get from the application that wouldn't recoup costs for the county or yourself. If there was, my next question is going to be, I think county obviously would take first position on recouping their costs, which it sounds like it's going to be fairly minimal anyway, but I would just want to make sure we have that conversation.
And I think the jurisdiction, it's up to them what the fee structure is. Kevin pointed out that amount, but across the country, there are other jurisdictions that have different fee structures.
Okay.
Yeah, so statutorily it is at 1% or 2,500, whichever is less, up to a maximum of 15,000. And that's where we have to work, because that's our statutory boundaries on that fee.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay, so I want to acknowledge the public comments that came in. We have Twin Tower Properties, Mac Water and Light. We have the City of McMinnville, the City of Dayton, and I may butcher this one, but it's Pastiche Properties. And then in person, we have Todd Severson. So come on down, go ahead and state your name and address, and then proceed with your comment.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Hello, County Commissioners and staff. My name's Todd Severson, address 14301 Muddy Valley Road, McMinnville, Oregon. I think most of you are familiar with our company, either visited or heard about us, but we are insect agriculture. We take manufacturing byproduct from the agricultural sector and feed it to our bugs, and out of that we could produce larvae that are animal feed and their bug poop, which is good fertilizer for our soil. So we recirculate waste streams in our region and put it back in as value-add nutrients. And I would like to read a prepared statement in support of the CPACE program. So good morning, commissioners, and thank you again for the support you've shown Chapul Farm over the years. About 4 years ago, you helped us purchase some of our earliest equipment, including our box truck, through a county grant. I believe Commissioner Sterrett was the only one around at that time. But that support played a real role in helping us get established here in Yamhill County. We're grateful for that partnership, and we're proud of the work we've done since then to build a new industry right here in the county. So our research center right now is on McPhillips Farm, by right behind the Agricultural Museum on Highway 18. And we've recently purchased the Spartech building behind the steel mill. And that'll be our first production facility that'll be able to take in about 50 tons of agricultural byproduct and produce about 10 tons of bug and 10 tons of bug poop each day. And so we've had money to purchase that building, but we're working on the construction funds for that right now. And that's where CPACE comes in. So Chapul Farm operates in a new agricultural sector, insect agriculture. And as you can imagine, being early in a new industry comes with challenges. One of the biggest has been assembling a full capital stack without giving up large amounts of equity or taking on short-term high-interest financing. Traditional lenders often don't know how to underwrite a business like ours yet, even though the fundamentals are strong. We have production, we have sales, we have people that are interested in coming in second position, but no one's willing to jump into that lead yet, and I think that's where CPACE can help us. So with CPACE, it's long-term, fixed-rate, private capital, not government money, and it's specifically designed for projects like ours, retrofitting older industrial buildings with modern systems. It aligns perfectly with what we're doing. The insects we grow do a lot of the work for us when it comes to energy and efficiency. They produce a lot of the heat and humidity. We just need heat pumps and fans to kind of move that around our building. And so that's the energy efficiency part. We're not installing solar. We're right there on Bonneville Dam. It doesn't make sense. We're using the infrastructure that's there, and we're using the insect energy to move smart throughout our building to keep our costs down. But we still have deferred maintenance, HVAC needs, insulation upgrades, water system improvements, and potentially seismic work to complete. And CPACE allows us to finance those improvements responsibly over the long term without putting strain on our operating budget or giving up ownership of the company. And importantly, the county doesn't need to spend a dollar, take on any debt, or assume any financial risks. This is entirely private capital. Your role is simply to authorize a mechanism so that private lenders can participate. And then obviously the hours to help stand up that program, but you know, 24 hours, 100 hours releases 2 to 3 million for us to keep developing in this county. So I ask, please take those hours on for us. We have a lender and investor identified who is interested in our project. They told us that less than 1% of private capital reaches rural markets. And not because rural businesses aren't strong, but because the financing tools aren't always in place. CPACE is one of the tools that help fix that. It opens the door for more private sector investment in rural counties like ours. By adopting CPACE, you empower property owners, strengthen the county's economic foundation, and support private sector investment, all without spending a single taxpayer dollar. For Chapul Farms, it means we can invest more deeply in this community and continue building a long-term presence in Yamhill County. Thank you for your time and for considering a tool that helps businesses like ours grow responsibly and sustainably through private investment.
Thank you, Todd. Yeah. Anybody have any questions for Todd?
Very compelling. You should have done this 3 years ago.
I'm just dying for Commissioner Sterrett to go out there and just see all the larvae wiggling around and just dig right into it.
It's better than when you asked me to go to the slaughter facility at Carlton Farm. And I was fantastic. Like, nope, not doing it.
The sausage machine?
No.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
Oh, and if I can add... Yeah. To address some of your concerns, Commissioner Sterrett, the statutory language simply references energy efficiency, renewable energy storage, smart electric vehicles, charging stations, and water efficiency. So it doesn't mandate the methods, just those tools. So we can work within that, or we can leave it that broad. And that's one of the reasons why I'm pretty supportive of this program, because it's a little bit more future-proof than a lot of these tend to be, because those are pretty open categories.
And one public comment that I forgot to mention that's in the packet is from the chamber also. If there's no other questions, I would like to move approval. Is there any further discussion on this?
No.
No, I think this is a no-brainer for us. It would be, I can't think of a reason not to, when we have partners that are willing to do some of the heavy lifting, and there's administrative cost is more or less, and we're enabling businesses to do $1 or $2 million worth of work. We have, you know, I look at old buildings in Newburgh, McMinnville, Wilhelmina, Sheridan, all, you know, in Dayton, a lot of these smaller towns that, you know, really could use the extra lift in incentivizing people to come in and retrofit them essentially for new business. And a lot of them are empty. So if this is a tool to give them, I don't see a reason why we wouldn't.
Agreed. And this is a little bit different from a few years back. I've had many a meeting with Patty and trying to discuss the where we're at presently with it. And I really do appreciate them stepping up and taking a lot of the cost burden off of this. And it just goes to show you how much they support our business community and trying to make this all come together and work. I will have one little concern, and this may be as we start either writing up an agreement or ordinance or however that looks, is that we need to come up with a backup plan or a secondary that will sign on to this, that if MEDP for some reason or some capacity can't take, can continue to take that burden from the county for that pre-application reviews, we need to find one other entity that's willing to take that on. And Patty probably could find them for us. So I just want a backup plan. Other than that, motion's been made. No further discussion. All those
Mr. Chair, I'm not, I don't know that you need to take any formal action. What is it that you're interested in having staff do? If it's just to go ahead and start working on the documents and preparing the board order or the resolution that would come back to adopt the program, I think all we need from the board is consensus to,
consensus. Okay.
To do that. So I don't know that a formal action.
So it sounds like there's consensus. That. Okay. So let's get the paperwork and get it in motion.
Okay. And part of the process, we'll have to notify each of the utility providers in the area that we're establishing this. So that means, you know, the city operated utilities as well as the power companies and things like that. So there's going to be a little bit of a couple of steps before we get it back. We're going to move it as quickly as we can. But
I can tell you right now that Patty or John or anybody involved here is more than willing to help us speed that process up. So I would suggest just getting in touch with Patty as you get going and see what they can do to help out. Cool. And appreciate
Chair,
it.
Are you interested in having more public process in terms of any kind of a public hearing or anything else on this? Or are we just ready to come back with either a board order or an ordinance for consideration by the board?
I think a public hearing process would be just burdensome for no reason on this.
There had been a mention before about possibly having some more input, but if we're ready to move forward, I don't think that's necessary. We can just prepare the
I document. Think once they get everything prepared, they can bring it before us. Yeah. As soon as it's prepared, we can do a review. If Patty has concerns, they'll figure it out in the meantime, and then we can sign off on it.
Very good.
Okay, thanks. Cool. Thank you very much, Patty. Thanks, John.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Todd. Thank you for everybody that submitted comments on this, and thanks, Don. I think he's finally dropped off. And thank you to our assessor.
Thank you, Derek.
Derek. Appreciate it. Yep. All right. Moving on, we do have a public hearing. J1. This is to consider the LUBA remand of the county's decision regarding docket number C-03-22, a conditional use request to operate a 9 guest room bed and breakfast facility as a home occupation. The applicant is Grange Hill LLC. Appellant is Friends of Yamhill County. The remand will be limited to accepting testimony, arguments, and evidence as to whether the subject dwelling identified as Grange Hill Estates, 9580 Northeast Warden Hill Road, Dundee, is a dwelling within the meaning of ORS 215-448 and YCZO 1004.01, including item C, including whether the dwelling will be occupied by the farm operator. And this is continued from January 8th. At the point of deliberation, and just to be super clear about that, we already closed the public hearing on that. So we are just continuing our deliberation portion of this. Who wants to kick us off?
I just wanted to share that when this first came before us in 2021, there were some concerns. At least we all were pretty much worried about the fact that we had really nowhere to go because of this, of these zoning ordinance precluded or supported this application. This has been contentious going forward. I think that if you look at the LUBA affirmation, it basically said that this is a dwelling and that it is operated as a dwelling that is normally allowed in this zone. I took a look at the county Country Inn Bed and Breakfast Facility Zoning Ordinance, and I do have some comments about going forward what I would like to see us do in terms of reducing the number of what they call sleeping rooms. But for now, this is pretty clear that our zoning ordinance allows this.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that I share some frustration with Thousand Friends, but I don't think that that is what we are tasked with today. And in this decision, this is much more of the state's hands than it is ours. And so I agree with Commissioner Sterrett.
Agreed. I can definitely see where the perception is, and I see the comparison between personal houses that I have, like the Del Smith estate that had 24 bedrooms and what. I'm not out to restrict anybody on what they can do and what size and what they can have in their personal home. Does this look like a hotel? Absolutely it does. Does it check all the boxes to fit in the requirements for the zoning ordinance and the Oregon statutes? Yes, it does. But I'm in agree with Commissioner Sterrett, and I guess I'd want to hear from Commissioner King if we can all agree that in the very near future, before this end of year is up, that we address this and see if there's changes that can be made that we can either reduce the bedroom requirements, or if there's other tweaks that we can make to this ordinance under our county purview that can make this a little bit more palatable. Ken Friday's got his hand up. If you want to go ahead and comment on that, Ken, jump in.
Yes, thank you. I would just want to say that I would like to see us go back down to a 5-room bed and breakfast and at least have a discussion about that and possibly have it be that it'd be required to be in the primary dwelling, so that you don't have folks arguing that they can build an additional structure. But having said all that, I still, would recommend approval of this with the 16 conditions that were previously approved and the additional one suggested by the applicant with findings to come back in 2 weeks.
Okay, I would make a motion of approval with findings to come back in 2 weeks. Is there any further discussion?
None.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Aye. Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Ken. And again, in the near future, if you can just type up a recommendation for us on your 5 rooms, that would kind of give us a starting point for discussion, and then get with Ken or Kevin and
we'll
get on the schedule for within the next few months. So really appreciate that.
Thank you.
And with that, it closes out public hearing items, and we are on to K, which is our announcements.
Again, keep it light again this week. Two things to really highlight. I met with Lindsay Manfrin this week, and Obviously, HHS kind of dominated our agenda today, so it warranted. And really, my bigger concern was about the contracts with CCO and what that looks like just moving forward. And just flagging that, you know, there's not a change in services today, but we're really right up against that wall at this point of what that looks like with further cuts to budget to HHS. And so I'm concerned about that. We also talked about a couple of other things, maybe with partnering. Chair Roberts out of Clackamas County had reached out to a potential project to partner with, and just some other our opioid dollars as well. The other one was my meeting with Cynthia at Public Transit, and we had decided not to move forward with our electric bus. They are underway with renovations there at Durham Lane. And of course, once you move into some projects, you find more projects to do. So there's some issues with HVAC and electrical that we're going to have to do with, so that we may see a change order come our way. But she asked me for some help with a grant that we have for that bus, for those electric buses, to maybe move some of the money over into some more energy efficient HVAC uses. So I was in support of that. She was able to get a yes from her, the Department of Administration. Is that which one it was? Yeah.
Yeah.
Administrative Services. Thank you. So kind of bad news, but some good news that there's money available for that. So that's all for me.
Thank you. Commissioner Stewart.
Legislative Committee met on Monday, Board of Directors, and I'm going to let you address the contentious vote that was taken on that research plan and cost study, although I'd be happy to jump in on that. But HHS Steering Committee met, and we talked about an actual cost study on the behavioral health costs, certainly taking a look at some of the general fund cuts, and talked about some of the most pressing issues, and talked about providing services with the available funds. But we do know that there has been a recommendation. There are 2.5 to 5% cuts across every agency, and how that is going to impact some of the services. Also, in terms of the Board of Directors, they did discuss spending almost $300,000 for an actual research and cost study. I don't know that I would have voted in favor of that, because I think we've got other entities looking at this, and we also know that we are seriously underfunded, but $300,000 for AOC is a lot of money. Also wanted to point out that we've heard a lot in the news about the child care fraud, for instance, in Minnesota. I believe it's up to $9 billion in the Somali fraud. So I think that even though HHS has recently cut child care and family assistance in five states, we're not one of them. I did reach out to Representative Elmer and wanted to see just what is the oversight on child care programs in Oregon. And she has been on the Early Childhood and Human Services Committee and has assured me that they are going to be taking a look at childcare-related programs here at the state level, including public records requests, calling around to various locations, and they're making it a priority, because with families needing childcare, it would be a crime to see folks who are not eligible to receive these funds getting them. The other thing that we found out in the news was that Oregon is now looking at taking a look at cleaning up their routine, outdated, inactive voter registration records. And the problem is that this has been a requirement all along. They haven't done anything since 2017. So we've got a lot of folks on the rolls that haven't been removed, and there have been lawsuits against the state. So fortunately, the state, the Oregon Secretary of State has announced they're going to be finally looking at that with a little push from the federal government. And they're also, the governor has agreed to look at the SNAP fraud because she's stepping that up, knowing that Oregon has one of the highest rates of food stamp fraud. So with a little push from the federal government, Oregon appears to be paying attention.
Thank you. While we're talking about AOC, the 300K cost study, I agree. And I voted against that. I think it might be coming back around because there definitely was, even though it passed, there was definitely a high percentage of opposition to that. My biggest concern with that was that the cost study, even though I think they're going down the correct path and the intention is correct, I can see the downsides to it with it possibly leading to some bad conversations about measures 5 and 50, mm-hmm. Which is our tax rate caps. So very slippery slopes, but the good news is I think we're going to have continued conversations about that, see if we can adjust the wording in it so that it doesn't end up, we don't end up getting into that conversation about 5 and 50. But I agree. That was a very interesting conversation. The other thing while we're out on the AOCs that we had Friday and Monday, LC 81 mm-hmm. is coming down. AOC is going to support that. I'm very thankful for the Property Tax Association for getting involved in that. Mm-hmm. And they really went to bat for all the farmers. The LC 81 was going to rewrite some rules for farm stands that were going to be very egregious and not good for the farmers, especially at a time when we need to be able to diversify as much as we can. So thankfully, AOC is all over supporting LC 81, rewritten per how the Oregon Taxpayers Association wanted it rewritten, and it looks good and promising. So, but everybody keep a close eye on that. It's LC 81. That wraps up my AOC business. Had Lafayette City Council, McMinnville City Council, they finalized their zoning for McMinnville Landing, which is fantastic. If you ever get a chance to look at McMinnville Landing or the, they renamed it McMinnville Landing. Just Google McMinnville Landing, you'll be able to see the zoning overlay. It'll show you how much commercial property that they're going to have along 18. And I think it's a nice blend from over the last umpteen years that we've been working on this from all the community outreach. This is what we ended up with, and it looks pretty good. They finally finalized that last night. So everybody's super happy. And now it's just a matter of finding some companies that are willing to roll in there and put in their companies. So the other one I have is Willamina City Council meeting. They updated their FEMA rules, which we actually did well over a year ago. They just now are getting to it. I think it's good for them. There's still a lot of concerns around those FEMA rules. I mean, back when we chose the case-by-case basis for the county, they were still trying to write the rules on it. And that's why we chose to do a case-by-case basis, even though for us it was, the application load was like one or two back when we discussed it. So they finally have their rules implemented. It's going to be interesting to kind of see how that plays out and how much impact it's going to have on the city of Willamina. The other city council meeting was last night, Amhill. They adopted a new lighting ordinance for their businesses. Fair Board is tonight. Parkway Committee met this morning. It was a really good meeting. We're trying to address the next steps for the bypass. And a lot of the conversation was about funding opportunities with the federal government, who is going to write the grants. Our Mid-Willamette Valley Council of Governments director was there to offer mm-hmm. their services to help write the grant. Who is going to be the applicant, whether it be tribes, the county, we'll figure out the details there, who's going to pay for it. So there's a lot of discussions coming up, but it is on the forefront. We are going to move quick. We are going to strike while the iron's hot. I remember when I updated last week that the most important thing that came from that meeting with the U.S. Department of Transportation was their offer to come out and visit. We are going to be in constant contact with them to make sure that that happens. So everything so far, I feel great about the progress, the direction we're going, and the how quick we're keeping it moving forward. And with that, that's all I got. So everybody have a great day. Thanks for coming, and I'll close it out.
Thank you.
And it's 11:40.